Sterling takes 8 years to watch or read anything, except for this pilot. But then he finally saw that third episode, and he was like, Dan, all anyone's going to talk about is my ass.
Hey everybody, welcome to this week's episode of The Envelope. Kelvin Washington alongside Yvonne Vidiel. We got Mark Olson as usual. And you two want to have a conversation about Emmy nominations. We know they're going to be coming up, and this will be the last episode before we find out who is nominated. So you got some, I don't know, some bold takes. You got some things on your mind. Here we go. Don't roll your eyes here.
No, I'm not rolling. I'm like, thinking? I'm getting ready. I just feel like, you know, streaming obviously still dominates a lot of the conversation, whether it's Severance or the studio. But I'm going to say I look forward to seeing my girl Kathy Bates get a nomination for Matlock on CBS. That is my prediction, and I'm sticking with it.
All right, Mark, you got a bold one for us?
Well, I'm going to go with Matt Berry for What We Do in the Shadows. The show just wrapped up its sixth and final season, and he's just been such a comedic powerhouse on that show, and season after season, he's been so inventive, so fun, and I just think it'd be great to see him recognized for sort of the totality of the work that he's done there.
All right, you mentioned the person I'm going to name is in the show you mentioned, Severance. Trimal Tillman. Milchick. And there's a moment on my other show that I do. I danced, and everyone said, "Oh my God, you're gonna beat Milchick? What do you think, you're Milchick?" Everyone's just screaming that. It was the whole thing. So that is one of those like signature moments of a season. That I think.
Why don't you ever do that here?
First off, it's early. You don't know what I'm gonna do the rest of this episode.
Okay.
You don't know.
I don't have a drum line here.
And I will say, you know, he's in the new Mission Impossible: The Final Reckoning, and I saw that at a public show. And the moment he came on screen, people cheered in the audience. Like, he has such a fan base from the show.
Yep, yeah. And that's a beautiful...
Well-earned.
Yeah, beautiful thing for him. Let's talk about you had something cool you got to do, Yvonne, speaking with someone that you're familiar with, Dan Fogelman, showrunner for Paradise. You got to do this at the Newport Beach TV Festival, where you sat down and had this conversation in front of a live audience. He got Showrunner of the Year Award as well. I know it's really cool, right?
It was very scary.
Stop it.
I don't like audience. Well, I do like audiences, but I do get a little nervous. But yeah, you know, speaking with somebody that I've talked to many times helped ease the sort of stage fright there. But yeah, I mean, Dan Fogelman is somebody that I've spoken to a lot of times over the years because I covered This Is Us from beginning to end. And it's funny because I remember last year I was on the set of Only Murders in the Building, which he is a producer on. And they were filming on the Paramount lot for their sort of trip to LA last season. And he had just started production on Paradise on the same lot. And he took a break and headed over to our sort of neck of the woods on the Paramount lot to show everybody this, you know, a cut of a scene that they had just wrapped for Paradise. He was so excited to share that with everyone. And he's like, Yvonne, you got to see this. You got to see this. And it's, you know, Sterling K. Brown doing a scene and you're just like, you know, in awe of it. But yeah, I mean, this show has political intrigue. There's a murder mystery. There's the, you know, destruction of the planet. And the premise is Sterling K. Brown plays a Secret Service agent who's accused of killing the president, and it's sort of, you know, trying to unravel who was really at fault here. And that's just, you know, on the surface. There's a lot more to it than that, because Dan Fogelman is known for his twists, and he didn't disappoint here. So it was really fun to unpack that with him in front of an audience.
A whole lot of twists in that show, for sure.
Yes.
So, all right, without further ado, let's get to that chat with Dan Fogelman. Here's Yvonne.
My name is Yvonne Villarreal, and I co-host the Envelope Awards podcast for the Los Angeles Times. And I hope you'll check it out, because this is our first live recording, but we often have the creative minds behind some of the best TV and film that's out there. And today is no different, because joining me today is Paradise creator Dan Fogelman. You're so far away, Dan.
I know.
Dan and I go way back.
Yes.
Way back.
This Is Us days.
This Is Us days. I had the great privilege of covering This Is Us from beginning to end. And that show, I think I would often come to you and say, why are you making me cry? And also, can you make me cry some more? This show, it was very much, what is going on here? Talk about the genesis of this show, because it actually predates This Is Us, the kernel of the idea. Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, I'd started thinking about this show long before This Is Us. When I was a young writer in Hollywood, they start sending you on all these general meetings, which is basically you go to meetings with important people with no agenda, and it can be a very awkward dance. You tell your same origin story 100 times. And at one of these meetings, I was meeting with like a captain of industry, like a very important person. And as that person was speaking to me, I was not hearing anything he or she was saying. I was calculating how much money I thought they were worth. I was thinking, is this a billionaire? Am I in the room with a billionaire? And on the way home, as I was driving home, I mean, this was a long time ago, it was in the shadow of 9/11, and in a nearby construction site dropped something, and it made a loud boom, and one of those booms that shakes you for a second. And I thought to myself, wow, when the shit really hits the fan, that guy's going to be as screwed as all the rest of us, because all the people that must take care of him are going to run after taking care of their own people. And so I started thinking about that. I started thinking about a Secret Service agent and a president, somebody whose job it is to take a bullet. And this idea of telling a murder mystery of an ex-president underground and learning later that the world has ended above. And so that was the impetus behind it. And then I kind of put it away. I wrote This Is Us, and I talked to some big sci-fi writers about the idea, thinking maybe I could produce it for somebody better than me to make it. And then when This Is Us ended, I was like, I'm going to try and do that one. And so it took like 15 years to come back around.
What do you remember what people were... the other sci-fi writers you were talking to, what were those conversations like about what do you think of this world? Because you said it so casually, like this was just like an idea that comes together. My brain doesn't work like that, Dan.
Yeah, I mean, well, I remember a couple of the conversations and people thought, oh, that's a cool idea, but that's as far as it goes, because that's a lot of work to then figure out the cool idea. And that became the problem with this show. I wrote it and then I had to sit down and figure out how we were going to do it, and what was the tone going to be, and what were the twists and turns. So they all kind of said like thanks but no thanks, because it seemed really hard, I think. And then I just waited and did it. But yeah, it takes a while, and it takes a village. It takes a lot of writers sitting with you and kind of figuring out how to shape the world.
So how much was it tugging at you during This Is Us and then after, where you finally were like, I'm going to sit down with this?
During This Is Us, I was pretty in This Is Us and a couple of other projects at the time. So it took, I had the final year of This Is Us, I had put up in my little home office. And the last 2 years were like fraught with COVID, and there was no more in-person stuff, and everybody was wearing masks on set. So it was like a really tough 2 years of a six-year show. And at the end, in the final season, we did 18 episodes, and I had 18 post-it notes on my wall in my office. And each time I would finish a script, I had 36. And each time I would finish a script, I would exit out, and each time I would finish an edit, I would exit out, because that was like how much left I had to do. And then they're still on my wall in my office to this day, because it was so exhausting, and it was like such a big accomplishment to just be done, that I when it was over, I was like, oh, now's the part where I take the post-it notes off the wall, and I never did, and they're still like hanging on by a thread there. But yeah, and then I kind of took a break for like 6 months, and I started getting the itch to write something, and that idea kept poking through. And so I just wrote it without telling anybody first.
Wow.
Yeah.
One of my favorite things about a creator like Dan, a writer like Dan, is you're that person that likes to watch people watch something. During This Is Us, I remember you would like, be so excited about a scene or something, and you'd be like, you gotta see, and you would like put it in the next room, and you wanted to see how I was reacting. And I remember for Paradise too, when you guys were starting production, Only Murders in the Building was shooting on the Paramount lot for their trip to LA, and you were doing Paradise at the same time, and you took a break to sort of come see the set of Only Murders, which you're a producer on, EP on. And you had this scene with Sterling, and you wanted to show it too. But you were hesitant about pitching this to Sterling, which I'm sort of surprised by, because I think you know when something's good. But talk a little bit about what made you nervous about giving it to him and what he would say.
Well, I'm a person who operates off of obligation. Like my best friend gave a speech at my wedding, said, like, you can ask Dan for anything and he'll feel like too guilty not to do it. He's like, he's my ride home tonight. That was his joke at my wedding. And so I felt worried that Sterling would feel obligated after This Is Us. And when we ended This Is Us, I remember very vividly Sterling rapping This Is Us, and like I did like a little impromptu quick thing when he was rapping, and I was like, Sterling, you go out in the world now and make us proud. Like, we could all see what's coming for Sterling and what remains to be coming for him. And I was like, go win your Oscars, don't forget us when you're even more famous, that kind of thing. And so to come back to him like a year and a half later with a script for another TV show with the same guy, I wasn't worried that he wouldn't like it. I was worried that it would put him in a weird position. And so he was so gracious. I sent it to him. I had written it, I think, picturing Sterling, but never vocalizing that to myself. And then I started like letting friends read it to get their feedback. And they're like, did you develop this with Sterling, or was it his idea? And I was like, no, I've never talked to Sterling about this. And it started occurring to me that if I didn't get Sterling, I had a huge problem, because that is who I've been picturing. And so I sent it to him, and he read it that day and called me back and said, tell me where it goes, because obviously if you watch the pilot, it doesn't tell you a lot about where it's going. And I gave him the broad strokes of where it was going for 3 seasons. I said, it's 3 seasons. I want to shoot it in LA. Here's what the arc of it is. Here's where it's going. Here's what happened in the world. And he said, I'm in. And we just kind of shook hands. And that day we were off to the races. And so,
what did he think about the twists in that first episode?
I mean, Sterling emotes, right?
Yes.
Like, so like when we bring Sterling will come into the writer's room. He's an executive producer on the show. And like, if you pitch him something surprising, he falls to the floor and rolls on his back like a golden retriever. Like, he reacts and he emotes. So he was really into it. I mean, he had the same question I think everybody had after the pilot, which is, what happens now? Mm-hmm. And I kind of had the rough answers. And but yeah, I mean, it's been a blessing. I mean, he, as you know, he's the best guy.
Yeah.
And he makes, you know, I was just outside and somebody was asking me, like, how do you get Julianne Nicholson and James Marsden to do your show? I'm like, well, it helps if you already have Sterling K. Brown, because they all want to work with Sterling, you know, and like, and hopefully they tolerate me in the script. You know, but so it's been a gift with him.
Mm-hmm. Talk about, you said Sterling sort of became the person you were thinking about as it evolved. How did you decide who should be which characters? Like, why was Sterling right for Xavier? Why was Julianne right for this tech billionaire? Talk about landing on who was right for which roles.
There's not a lot of art to it. You just kind of see it in your brain a little bit. You know, Sterling I'd worked with, I'd known Julianne and James from their work, not personally. The other actors in the show, for the most part, though I'd known of their work or whatnot, most of them read, and when you're doing this job, a big part of your job is you see a lot of really beautiful talent people read the same lines of dialogue, mm-hmm. and your job is to think which person fits it the best and which person makes it most interesting. John Beavers, who plays Billy Pace, was an actor I didn't know. He played the character Billy, and I really wanted him from the moment I saw him on tape. I was like, this is the guy for that part. But I knew, because it was only 4 episodes, that there might be like a clamoring for a bigger name in the part.
Mm-hmm.
Because it would be possible, because you could go cast anybody because it's a month of work.
Right.
And if they were willing to pay him, that might be. And so John came in and he read again. And then you get to a part where it's like chemistry tests.
Mm-hmm.
And he was reading with Nicole, who played his, and a couple other people who would play Jane. And I just loved him. And he walked out of the room at the end of it. And I ran out after him. And I said, John, would you ever look at a new scene that I haven't given you yet? It's from the 4th episode. And you've only had the pilot to audition off of. But would you take a look at it and maybe come back in here and read it? Because I knew the scene was big. And I wanted to have a piece of material that would be undeniable if I needed it to win with the powers that be. And John sat with the scene for 3 minutes and came in to me and said, I'm ready. And he came in and it became his big scene right before his death in the show, where he confronts Julianne's character, Sinatra. And I actually, when I first zoomed with Julianne, I showed her the scene. I was like, you wanna see something cool? This guy did this in 3 minutes without any preparation, and look how good it is.
Mm-hmm.
And so part of it is just like a gut instinct or really liking somebody for it. And I had that with everybody in the cast on this one.
the way the show was marketed coming in.
Should I be funnier? I feel like I should be funnier.
Up to you.
Okay.
We could bring the right, laughs
no.
here.
It feels so
Abbott
serious.
Was before us.
It's
they so don't serious. Have to have
Were
all the
Were they funny? They must have
yeah.
been funny.
Yeah.
Shit.
Do you got a Sterling story?
What's my best Sterling story?
I mean, he's bare naked in this.
Oh, my God. He was like, he was so, when I first showed him the, because Sterling takes 8 years to watch or read anything, except for this pilot. And so it drives me crazy, because I want Sterling to like it, and I'm very excited. I'm like, have you seen the second episode? He's like, I haven't had time, man. I'm like, you haven't had time to watch a 50-minute episode of television? It's been a month, and it drives me crazy. But then he finally saw that third episode, and he was like, Dan, all anyone's going to talk about is my ass. Is it going to be released in the first batch of episodes? Because he went like 100 years down the road and was seeing the press where they always wanted to ask a question about his ass. But he loves it, and he's so proud of it. And the first person to see Paradise was my mother-in-law. And I showed them the first three episodes at home before anyone had seen it, my wife and my mother-in-law. And she had lived and breathed This Is Us with me because, you know, my wife was in the show. And when that part came on in the shower, she started fanning herself. And she said, oh, Sterling. and that made him very happy. So that was his proudest moment of the show, I think.
Amazing. The show is marketed as this, you know, political thriller. This idea that looms over the season is who killed the president. But then you get to the final moments of that season opener, and you realize, okay, there's a lot more to this. This seemingly all-American town is really this, you know, community carved under like a Colorado mountain after an apocalyptic event. Tell me what was going through your mind of when, how do I piece this out? And how like meticulous were you in the edit of like, this is revealing too much too soon. We gotta make it less that. Talk to me about it.
It's less in the edit, because at the edit you're already kind of pretty bound to what you've scripted, but it was in the writing stages. Like my intent for the show was that in the first season of 8 episodes, we were going to provide answers every week, ask new questions, and then hopefully it provided a complete meal by the end of the season, where for the most part, I think any question you've been asking in the course of the first season of the show is answered by the end of the season. And we tried to do that I was very clinical about that. I get frustrated when shows give you too much too quickly, but also when they withhold for too long. And I thought for this one, I wanted to be really calculated about it. So, you know, in the second episode, you start learning, oh, wow, the world really did end. Something catastrophic happened. And you're learning more about Sinatra. But you've also, in the opening sequence of season 2, Sinatra is telling all these other scientists that something imminent is coming for the world. And then we would constantly in the writer's room put ourselves in the mind's eye of a television audience. If I was watching at home, mm-hmm. I'd say, oh, they're all in the Truman Show. This is all fake. It's a social experiment. So at what point do we get rid of that theory for the audience? You know, at what point do we tell the audience and show the audience what actually happened on the day the world ended? And so that was really calculated with how we were going to parse it out.
Mm-hmm. Something that was interesting is, you know, press get a lot of the episodes ahead of time. I think I had the first 7 before it premiered. And then it was interesting watching people watch it week to week and see their reactions on social media. The show launched with 3 episodes where we get enough of like reveals and everything, and then it switches to week to week. Talk about how much were you involved in those discussions of like, I want to start with 3 and then I want it to be this delved out this way.
That was a big conversation. I mean, I'm lucky enough to be in a position. I've got a great like studio and network who involved me in the conversations. I don't know if I could move the needle if I disagreed strongly with anything, but they at least involved me in it. At first, I thought my first instinct had been like, let's let the pilot be the only thing that gets put out in the world and let people talk about it and what that ending says. But then you have to acknowledge the fact that, you know, people are being served television in just a very different way these days. And like the whole point of the show is I wanted to make something that was hopefully artful and well done, but also propulsive, and you don't want to frustrate people. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we're accustomed to hitting like that drip of like next episode. So while I did want that week to week build and momentum, I was also aware we have to give them a little bit more to like hook them in. Mm-hmm. And ultimately you trust the people that they're like, we know how things play. I wanted this show to get seen. Mm-hmm. And I thought, so that was a big conversation. Was it 1 episode? Was it 2? Mm-hmm. or was it three? Ultimately, they decided three. And then the downside of that is you get less weeks to build the momentum of a television show that people are starting to talk about. It worked in our favor this time. I think it's what we're going to do this coming season, most likely, is we do it on Only Murders as well, release two or three up top. But I come from, I did This Is Us and other network television shows where it was like, you know, when This Is Us launched, it had that big twist ending, and then people sat on it for a week and talked, but it was a different time.
Yeah.
You know, it was 2016, and we were not as on that Netflix kind of drip of like just sitting like hamsters hitting the dopamine button. You know what I mean? Like more and more and more. And so you have to weigh that. I love a weekly release, and I love, my whole goal with this show was, you know, I was so eager with the show and with Sterling in this cast to capture a small sliver of the zeitgeist where people could be talking about something, hypothesizing and talking. And I knew that required a weekly release, but how many to get people like locked and loaded was a big debate.
What was the episode or the moment that you were most eager to see how people responded to?
That's a really good question. I mean, I was really, so my process is always has been, I find strangers, like I could pick out 20, like, and I try and have them vetted by people who know them. So friends of my writers, friends of my actors, and I start bringing them into my edit bay early and screen for them. And it's not like, there's this old screening process that used to happen in television and film, which is really bad because you just like literally give people dials. I mean, are you guys familiar with this? And this is how old TV was made. I watched it on my television shows, and you give people dials and you say, when are you liking something? Turn up your dial, when not? And then all you'll hear is they don't like that actor, they don't like that moment. And I'm like, well, yeah, the grandfather was dying. I don't expect them to be going, wee! You know what I mean? Like, and so it was a very broken system, but I do believe in like, screening stuff for people and seeing how they react, even if you're not going to change it, and even if you go, well, you're stupid, you don't get how brilliant I am, at least to get that reaction. And so I bring in like people into my edit bay all the time, and strangers who sign NDAs, and I would do that on This Is Us, I do that here. And so I was very interested to see what happened at the end of the pilot to people, like, are they following it, are they following the ending the right way, the way I want them to. After the you would start hearing murmurings in the room as the camera's rising and as the guy's going, the world's ending, and they realize they're underground. And then after, I will say things like, when did you start realizing something was amiss? Did any of you get ahead of it? Mm-hmm. And I will kind of get a little bit more granular. So that was a really exciting moment. It was exciting knowing that in the fourth episode when we killed a character, watching an audience like, in my small little edit bay, watching them go with that episode, knowing we were about to pull the rug out from under them and that they were going to have a reaction. Yeah. That was exciting. It's exciting when it goes the way you want it to go, you know? Like, they were turning to me going, you motherfucker, you can't, you know? And like, I was like, oh, good. That's a good day at work. And yeah, and all that, the last couple of episodes, watching people watch that last episode and feeling them, like, move with the explosions, that's, like, my most exciting thing. You lose it. I started doing films, and this experience of communally watching stuff you don't get in television. And so for me, like, you get limited opportunities to watch people react to the thing that you slave over every detail of as a group. Like, I have 300 people making our TV show right now, and we never get to see people watch it. And so that's a really exciting part.
But fans are so savvy, and the way that they watch is, you know, they can rewatch, they can zoom in, they can pause and really look at details. How is that for you? Like, are you ever worried they're going to get to, like, the mystery before you've gotten there? And how do you deal with that?
Totally. I mean, that I screen ad nauseum. And you know, as an example, like, in our premiere, there's an assassination attempt of the president in the premiere. And the guy doing the assassination attempt is a character that hides in plain sight throughout the series, and then we get to the end, and that's the murderer.
Spoiler alert.
that actor's like mother or longtime manager was at the premiere, and said to the actor, oh, I wish I got to see an episode you were in. And he was like, I was in that episode. And she said, what? And so we do that level of testing where we feel pretty confident when it's going out in the world, it's not going to get spoiled. But like at the end of the pilot, we were locking our pilot, the first episode, I think like a month before the holidays, before Christmas, to air in January. And the big expensive shot was the big final shot that goes up and reveals the inner workings of the dome. And I showed my brother-in-law and my sister-in-law. My brother-in-law was like, had taken way too many like weed gummies, so he wasn't the best audience, but I was... And he thought, at the end, it ended, and he was a little stoned, but he said they were visiting for Thanksgiving. And he's like, are they on outer space? Are they in outer space? And I kind of was like, you're so stoned, you need to stop with the weed gummies. But then, like, somebody else in the room was like, oh, I thought that for a second. And I went back into my writers. I was like, I was like, go screen it for your families more. And, like, one out of every 20 person was having a misunderstanding that they were in a space station. Mm-hmm. And so... And so we went back and we spent a fortune, and I had people work over the holidays too, because I got more granular. I was like, what is it that's saying space station to people? And it was these red lights we had combined with a couple of other different lighting choices. And we went back to the drawing board with our visual effect, the one that currently airs in the pilot, to make sure there was like no confusion about what was going on at the end of it. So like, that's the level of like, cause like we take it really, I've always said like good television is made by people who take it way too seriously. And like, and I have like, you know, 20 people in my writer's room and 300 people on my crew that take it really seriously. And that's part of it.
How does it compare to sort of the secrecy that surrounded This Is Us? I mean, there were red scripts. Like yeah. You said, there was the NDA. How does it compare?
I think the world has moved faster now, so I'm less worried about it. I mean, This Is Us was an anomaly because it was so in the zeitgeist for a moment. How did he die and what were the secrets? But it was also so early mm-hmm. in like this moment of the internet and spoilers and whatnot that now I've kind of chilled out a little bit. Like, I do only murders in the building, and the showrunner of that show, John Hoffman, is very frenetic all the time that if one little Easter egg is in a yeah. trailer, it's going to ruin the surprise for everybody. And I worry a little bit less now, maybe because I'm old and lazy, but like I worry a little bit less. And I think the media is pretty forgiving. I watch Survivor. I don't know if anybody's a Survivor fan. I love Survivor. It's my favorite show. And I'm so tired of those like blurbs you see on your timeline that they show the face of the person who got voted out the night before. It drives me absolutely insane. Yeah. And so I have to like blur my vision all the time, and like I hate it so. But I think for the most part, the media has done a better job of like, if there's a spoiler, you're going to have to dig for it as opposed to it being accidentally mm-hmm. in your face. Mm-hmm. I thought White Lotus, they did it, everybody was really responsible with it this year in that way.
Yeah. Inherent to this apocalyptic event is this idea of starting over, starting fresh, and trying to sort of, you know, correct some of the mistakes or errors of the past. What intrigued you about those sort of existential questions at play here?
Well, I mean, I think we're all there a little bit right now, right? I mean, I had this idea 15 years ago, and like the idea that the world was like everything was changing and it was quicksand under our feet was a little less prevalent back then.
What a time.
I mean, I think ultimately I was very drawn in the early years of The Walking Dead. I thought that those early seasons of that show were so good because ultimately it wasn't about zombies or apocalypse. It was about, you know, if the shit hits their fan, what levels will you go to protect the people you love, right? Like, how far would you break? Breaking Bad, you know, like, and so I was interested in that notion. I was interested in the notion of putting, like, a really good man in the center of it as opposed to an anti-hero, because Sterling exudes decency as a human being, and then this character is so hard and quiet and old-school action hero. I was, like, curious about what it was like to put that guy in that world, so that appealed to me. But yeah, I mean, I think that's part of it. I went to a little carnival recently, and my little boy wanted to get a balloon animal, and he was like really patiently waiting in line for the balloon animal, and I was like watching him, and he was like really patiently just waiting and waiting and waiting, and this mother kept coming over and bringing multiple kids and cutting the line in front of him. Because her kid was in front of him, and she kept bringing friends and other kids. And I was like, I was using it as like a case study, and I was like watching my little boy. I'm like, I wonder how he's going to react. And he stood there patiently, but we also knew the balloon animal guy said like 5 more minutes, and I'm packing up. So I was like, oh, is he going to run out of time? And I was originally watching it as a case study on my little boy. And then I started filling with rage. Uh-huh. And I was like, I'm going to kill this woman. I'm going to have to go over and be the parent who says, excuse me, ma'am. your children are not in line for the balloon animal. My son is. And I was like, no, don't do it. Don't do it. And so all that stuff really fascinated me what started happening in me as I held back and didn't say anything. And he got his balloon animal. And he's a spoiled little brat. He's fine. But like. But that stuff really intrigues me, especially if you raise the stakes to end of the world and all of that.
What did it make you think about in terms of the lengths you'll go to?
Well, I think we'd all go to extraordinary lengths. Whereas The Walking Dead focused that, this focuses a little bit more on what are the people in position of power to do. I mean, as you learn more about Julianne's character, Sinatra, you know, what length will you go to save not just your own family, but a portion of humanity? Like, what are the right things to do in these situations? And so it takes my balloon animal story and puts it on steroids a little bit. And that was really interesting to me.
Well, speaking of case studies, I feel like we're living a case study right now in terms of a president and the people around him and the influence or power that they have. And obviously this predates some of the headlines with whether it's Trump and Elon Musk or whomever. What was the research you were seeing about the power dynamics in a role like that that were interesting to you at the time?
Yeah, I mean, that an example I give of like the headlines, because that really caught us off guard, the Elon Musk president relationship. Because there was one point in like our third episode where there's a scene where in a flashback, Julianne walks into the Oval Office from a side room. And I remember having like my bullshit meter going off on my own television show going like, is this realistic? Like, she's not the chief of staff of this guy. Could she really be walking in and out of the Oval Office? And then lo and behold, here we are like all this time later. So I was like, I guess it's realistic. Our research was actually somewhat more focused on the logistics of building a bunker city, of governing in a bunker city, of what would the electric vehicles be like, how would they source food and clothing. There are so many more answers hidden in the production design of the show than you actually see on screen. In terms of, we had a dissertation written by a professor of sociology on how the best way to govern would be, which ultimately in our research turned out to be, if this situation happened, a benevolent dictatorship was deemed the best form of government for this particular situation by people who said, how would you keep people alive and in a functional way? Like, and I'm not talking in the United States, I'm talking about in this bunker city. And that's what we think in our mind's eye, Sinatra had the research to see, saying, I'm going to try and do the right thing for all of these people down below as best I can and try and keep the people at bay. You know what I mean? And so we did a lot of research on governance, on infrastructure, on things about nuclear and thermo energy that I can't fathom nor understand, but that my writers all understood how the place was powered and all of that. Mm-hmm. A little less on power dynamics between billionaires and power, just because I think you kind of know what that is. You know, it's a lot of people in a room who are used to being the only person who everybody listens to, and what's that complication like?
But also, who do you trust? I mean, Cal is like, he's got Xavier, he's got her. It's interesting to see, like, whose input do you take in?
Yeah, and ultimately, I mean, I think as an audience, we try and, as writers, we try and make everybody fallible, but also everybody kind of have a point of view and a place where they're coming from. I think in the second season of the show, you'll see where Sinatra was coming from on the big picture a little bit even more. You kind of know where Marsden's coming from. You know where Sterling's coming from. And those are all the kind of people pushing against one another in the show.
Well, and no matter what side of the political spectrum you fall on, I feel like everybody feels like we're in a doomsday situation at the moment, like whether you're for or against something. So I'm curious what that's like. How do you create escapist TV at a time like this where people have issues on either side?
It was a concern. I remember when the show was coming out, having a degree of concern about that. It just based off the timing and things I couldn't control. I mean, I do think that it's hard to, we've been here, I believe we've been here in different ways before. Like, when you look at, like, all the periods in history, it always felt at different points of our history, like, oh my, wow, the sky is really falling now. This is for real this time. This isn't like it was like for our parents' generation or the generation before. This is worse. And I think that the X factor right now that's making people say, no, this is the one that's the worst, is the technology has shifted so dramatically. Mm-hmm. And we're talking about things, you know, when the Archduke Ferdinand was assassinated, it was with, you know, a single person. Now those single people have much more scary stuff. The technology and the AI is much scarier. And so I think that is a little bit of a place thing that, and so I was very conscious of, I wanted to make something that had climate change as a factor, but I also wanted to create a scenario that wouldn't be the one that would keep people up at night. This is an extreme kind of worst case scenario, kind of fluke occurrence that could happen. It's based in some science, but it's not the most likely way the world is gonna end. And so we were trying to find ways like that so it could be palatable. You know what I mean? And
Thanks for that assurance, because that was my concern. Yeah. How likely is this to happen?
But you know, we have a writer on our show who's one of the foremost experts on climate change.
Please talk about that, Stephen.
Stephen right? Markley. He wrote a novel recently. It's a masterpiece of a novel. He was hired for the show because of it, called The Deluge. And you know, it is such a present, near-term catastrophe. And you know, part of entertainment is, you know, we created a big tsunami and a big crazy action adventure episode of television that's formed it. The reality of climate change will happen quickly, but in less, world encompassing kind of ways. And if we don't get on top of it, it's a huge, huge catastrophe waiting to happen. So, you know, as an example, and Stephen covers this in his book, and I'm by no means a climate change expert, but a lot of us roll our eyes when we talk about 6 inches of sea level rise, because it doesn't seem like the thing that's going to necessarily end the world. But along with the many, 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 many things that come along with that, it will create, when that inevitably happens, if we don't stop, when parts of Miami go kind of underwater, it won't be a drowning of a half of a state or a city necessarily, because it will happen slowly and then quickly. But what will happen is, as we've seen out here in California with the fires, you're talking about an economic and housing collapse, economically, purely economically, that will dwarf anything we saw in 2008. Because if you think about how hard it is to get your home insured now in California, just wait. And wait till the economic so that's the stuff that's like less sexy than a tsunami sweeping over a 400-story right. building. But it's like, unless we get our heads out of our asses, it's coming. So our balancing act is, how do we make something not pedantic, make it entertainment, make it so that you can do it, but also kind of like maybe shake people a little at the same time.
The conversations in that writer's room must be insane. Yeah. Like, it just feels like TED Talks all the
yeah,
time.
It's also a lot of fart jokes. Yeah, it's like, yeah. it's a nice balance.
It's
but
a
yeah,
nice balance.
It's a heady, heady place, and we're dealing, you know, and season two deals with a lot of really heady stuff, and I try and understand it as best I can, and then let the smart people battle it out. Yeah.
I want to get into some of the details of the show, because details make everything, right? Can you talk to me about why we?
You know, we just thought it was funny. but also, in season two, you'll learn the origin of the we for Jane. We're doing a big in season two of the show. Our sixth episode that we're shooting right now actually is called Jane, and it's her backstory episode. Okay. So yeah.
How about the fries? How did you land on the
cashew?
Well,
we landed on the fries primarily because we decided there would be no dairy down below, because having real dairy would require so much maintenance of chickens and eggs and infrastructure and animals and cows that it wouldn't be feasible. So cashew and nut cheese was like the kind of thing that would put on cheese fries. And we thought it was an interesting way of making it a key clue in the show, but that also tied into where they were and what they don't have.
Are we going to learn any of the other songs on Cal's mixtape? Are they important?
No, there is another song that plays heavily towards the end of our season from his oeuvre of music. But no, we're actually getting very Elvis heavy this season, season two, not related to Cal's music.
Okay.
That's a bit of a spoiler. But
okay. You heard it here first.
Spoiler. Yeah.
Can you talk about Phil Collins of it all? And finding that cover?
Yeah.
Because was it originally like, we want the Phil Collins version, or no, we want this really eerie,
yeah,
scary version?
Originally, the show was called Paradise City, and the song at the end was Guns N' Roses' Paradise City. And so that was actually the title. And then I soured on it as a title, and it made the song being the song less important. And when I got my first editor's cut of the pilot, she had found that cover, Julia, our editor, and put it in, and I was like, oh yeah, that's it. Like, that's the one. But yeah, in my mind's eye, I always thought it would probably be a cover of one of those two songs. I don't know why, because there's something about 80s music that's really, you're really on a fine line when you use it on a show or in a movie, where it, like, because of the genre movie that is and because of what it evokes in all of us, it can get funny quickly, mm-hmm. even if accidentally, mm-hmm. right? And so, like, taking those songs and, like, We Built This City,
right.
if you put that in without it being a cover, like, it makes you smile, but maybe in the wrong way in the genre of television. And so we felt that it would be good to use covers from the very beginning that mm-hmm. could, like, evoke the songs but kind of transform them a little bit.
What, I mean, this show has you thinking about budgets in a different way because you're dealing with special effects or yep. action scenes in a way you weren't on This Is Us. What's a, like, a scene from the series we'd be surprised got a lot of notes because you gotta be like, I don't know if we can do it this grand because this is what we're working with?
No, we never got that. We genuinely had, we have a really great studio and network that work with us. I mean, we're given the money we have, and then it's how do we choose to use it. So we knew, like, episode 7 was going to be an expensive episode for us where you show the world actually ending. So what we would do is on episodes 5 and 6, if we needed to cut a corner here or there, we would do that to save up the money for that. But we never really had that on this show. I mean, but we also stayed on budget, so I'm sure we would have had that if we were over budget. But, yeah, we never really had that. Good. Yeah.
You're about to get the Showrunner of the Year award. And as a fellow writer who's very fearful of ever becoming management, I'm very interested to know how writing or how your creative process has changed since becoming a showrunner.
That's a good question. It's a big job. I don't always relish it. I was with a group of showrunners the other night for a different thing, and we were all just, like, lamenting how exhausted and miserable we all were, and in a funny way, because we also all love it. The management is tough. You're the CEO of a large company. Like, I say 200, 300 people. It's really 1,000 people when you talk about the people who day play and do special effects and visual effects and all of the stuff. It's a lot of bodies, and you're managing a lot of people, and managing people is the hardest part of your job. Mm-hmm. You try and make, you know... It takes up a lot of time, and then I've tried to, I don't go to set very much anymore. I did at the beginning of my showrunning career because I felt like I should, and because I wanted to be there because I was the boss, and I started realizing, like, it was just not a good use of my time. I'm better served, I mainly focus on writing, breaking the episodes, writing them, and editing them, and that's where my time goes. But you need to be there for people. And on any given day, there's somebody on your crew who's not happy with something, and you're navigating, putting out those fires. It's a tremendous amount of work. I've also, one of the things that's been striking to me, and I say this to people all the time, is, you know, at the end of This Is Us, I would make gestures to people who worked on the show, whatever they were. But what would stand out more than anything, and I always felt like it was like doing so little, like to write somebody a note on stationery, you know mm-hmm. what I mean? And I was constantly struck by how much it meant to people to be yeah. individually seen. And I was like, man, people are really kind of lovely and great and don't require that much. They just want to be, like, seen, and they want their work to be seen. And it's the difference between writing a little note to somebody that says, you're doing a great job, versus I saw what you did on Tuesday, on Thursday, and with that scene, and it's not lost on me, and I see you, and I appreciate you, and I'm like, it takes 1 minute of my time, but I've learned how meaningful it can be to people, and you try to be better at it, and then you inevitably fail, and if you're a decent person, you go home scolding yourself, but it's been an eye-opening, weird experience, yeah.
Well, before we wrap, I know we talked earlier backstage that you're about halfway through shooting season 2,
yep.
and you're going to tell us everything that happens.
Yes.
But what can you share?
I'm really excited about it. I just started editing. Like you said, I show people stuff all too much. And so I've just started editing the first 2, and they're really good. And
how soon do things pick up?
Right after. We're living in it's a slightly different show at times in the second season, in that, like, part of the season lives outside in the world. And we've lived almost entirely claustrophobically inside the bunker in this season. And we do live there a lot in season three and pick up directly from where we left that world. But you're also living in Sterling's story and the story of the people he comes across. And those stories eventually collide. So it's a different, exciting show. Shailene Woodley, the actress, joins the cast this year. And I just wrote her a note. She's extraordinary in the show. And I think, like, I'm really excited for people to see her in it. I'm really excited about it. I'm like, when you're doing something different, it's, like, exciting and daunting, and that's, like, the best kind of feeling. And you're like, oh, I'm not dead inside. I'm really excited about this season. So,
Is there something that won't make sense now but will when we watch?
Elvis.
Elvis, okay. Any other people from This Is Us making an appearance?
Right now, yes, there's a few. I'm careful of it because I don't want it to get distracting with Sterling. I did a show called Gallivant, and one of my actors in it, Tim Amundsen, was like one of my favorite actors ever. And he had a part in This Is Us, and now is joining in a part here. There's another one that I think they'll yell at me if I announce it, but it's a
small. No one can hear. But
I'm always looking at stuff to do with those guys. I just saw Mandy and Chris Sullivan the other day, and I'm always looking for stuff for those guys, Milo and Justin and all those guys.
Maybe that'll be a tease.
Yeah.
Well, joining us now is going to be Julianne Nicholson to present Dan.
Oh my goodness.
With Showrunner of the Year. Julianne is the tech billionaire that is not... I don't know. We use villain like this because there's more to her.
Yeah. Especially, wait till Notcha. Season two. Season two tells it more.
Yeah.
What happens now? Oh, my goodness.
I'm going to say something about
you. Okay. Oh, jeez.
Hi, everyone. Okay. It's so nice to be here with you. And that was so interesting to hear you talk about all that. I have to say, I have things to say about Dan, but also he's really one of the most loyal people. I'm just reminded when I hear him talk about these actors that he continues to work with. Any conversation that I hear from Dan about people he's working with, he went to college with them. And I feel like that speaks so highly to who he is and how he keeps the people close that he loves, and they all are completely devoted to him, as am I now. And it's just such one of the wonderful qualities about Dan, whose body of work as a writer, executive producer, speaks to the kind of creator and storyteller he is. He hates this.
Yeah.
He likes this as much as he likes getting his picture taken. He's someone who's deeply interested in human connection and the communities we choose to surround ourselves with. He also just has an innate understanding of what we want to watch. It's sort of remarkable. He's been working in the industry that is Hollywood for a long time, and one of the challenges we're facing now is bringing back and keeping production in Los Angeles. And with Paradise, he did just that. And it's just one example of who he is as a person in supporting and giving back to the industry that keeps storytelling alive. It is one of the great privileges of my career to be a part of the community, no pun intended, that helped to build Paradise, and even more grateful that Dan trusted me with Sinatra. From season one, everyone on set shared the undeniable feeling that we really were working on something special. And we are so humbled that the show resonated with so many people. And we are very excited to be bringing you more with season two to continue Dan's vision. You just won't find a more generous, loyal, self-deprecating, funny fanboy of a showrunner than Dan. And I'm immensely proud to call him my boss, my collaborator, my friend. And so it is with great pleasure I present you with this Showrunner of the Year award. Thank you, Newport.
Thank you. Wow, this well, that's. Thank you. Oh my goodness! Thank you, Julianne. Wait, can I tell you guys a Julianne story? Should I say it? I'll tell you quickly. I just did a thing about it. When Julianne and I talked about doing this, she said yes, and then I got a call like a couple weeks later that she couldn't do it because she was on another television show and there had been a screw up with dates and she wasn't going to be available when we were shooting. And I was like so heartbroken that I lied to the studio and told them I wasn't ready to go into production. And it cost like so many gazillions of dollars. But I told them I'm not ready and we have problems. We have to push production. And I got like a slap on the wrist for wasting money. And then I was like, okay, she can do it now because now we're pushing 3 weeks. So that's how it gets you.
Congratulations.
Well, thank you, guys. This is so lovely. And I mean, we so rarely, I was getting asked outside, and this all makes me wildly uncomfortable being in front of things. But thank you for this and for this festival. I was getting asked outside, and you know, our community is shrinking. Television's in a weird spot right now. We're really fighting to keep work in Los Angeles. And opportunities to kind of spend a bunch of days together with a group of people who are like-minded, who love it, who as fans or work in the business is like such a wonderful thing to have kind of happening for our business in the world. So thank you for this, and thank you to Newport TV Fest for having me, and to Hulu and 20th for putting this together, and Yvonne for hosting.
Thank you.
And
Juliette. Thanks. This was our first live recording of our podcast, and it was so great having you. Thanks so much for taking the time with us, and you guys too. Thank you.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Bye.
Thank you.
All right, that's going to do it for this episode of The Envelope. Make sure you come back after the Emmy nominations. That is when we will return with more episodes of The Envelope. So we will see you then.